Registration is now open for the 2018 Apologetics Canada Conference. The conference is located in beautiful Abbotsford, British Columbia on March 2nd and 3rd. We have another amazing lineup of speakers. Get all the details and register at apologeticscanadaconference.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the AC Podcast. This is Steve Kim.
Andy Steiger.
Terry Crosby.
All three of us are here. This is good. Now, before we get started, I have a quick announcement for you. Apologetics Canada and Westside Church in Vancouver, BC are partnering to bring you a very important dialogue. So whatever you're doing Wednesday evening on February 28th, especially if you're in Vancouver, you need to clear your calendar and come listen to this dialogue between a Christian and a secular humanist on the foundation for human rights. Which one is the better foundation for human rights? Is it Christianity or is it secular humanism? So defending the former, that Christianity provides a better foundation for human rights, we'll have Dr. Andy Bannister, the director from Sola Center for Public Christianity, a friend of ours at Apologetics Canada. And then on the other side, his dialogue partner is Ian Bushfield. He's the executive director of the BC Humanist Association. And so they will be coming together to have this very important dialogue. So if you're at all interested in LGBTQ rights, pro-life, pro-choice, whatever other rights that you can think of.
Or maybe you've got a friend that's interested in all this, and this could be an opportunity to invite mm-hmm. them out and for them to be able to hear a Christian perspective to human rights.
Yeah. So admission is free, but you do need to RSVP. So you need to go to apologeticscanada.ticketbud.com. apologeticscanada.ticketbud.com, and you'll see the event there, and you can sign up for it. TicketBud is spelled TicketBud, just as it sounds, TicketBud.com. So you go there, RSVP, and hopefully I'll do a half-decent job moderating
this
thing.
Yeah, Steve Kim's going to be moderating, and we're all going to be there. I'll be opening things up, talking about human flourishing. Mm-hmm. Looking forward to it. Looking forward to partnering with Westside in this. Yeah.
And I'm doing a little song and dance.
Terry will be there.
I will.
Yeah. Awesome.
That's to start off the whole show. Just
talk about starting off the whole show. Terry Crosby.
Hey.
Do you got anything for us from the internet?
For sure. I got one. Coming from the Huffington Post under the category Weird News.
All right.
You know you're in for something special.
It says Jesus' statue was hiding a 240-year-old secret message. The Cristo del Misteri.
I think you pronounced that perfectly.
Thank you.
Wow.
I thought I did. A statue of Jesus Christ on display at the cathedral in Spain has been hiding a secret message for hundreds of years in the most unlikely place. It was tucked away in the hidden compartment of the statue's rear end.
Oh.
Is this real?
This is for sure real. You can check it out.
Wow.
God bless the ancients.
So this message was in a box, stuck up in the rear end part.
Oh, my.
Yeah. It was pinned in 1777.
I would have loved the conversation when that was had. Hey, listen, I know I'm making a statue, but I got this great idea.
Well, I think they're saying it was put in there a little bit later by this guy, by a chaplain of the cathedral at that time. But the letter itself talks about games that were popular at that time. It talks about just crops of what was happening around that period of time.
So it was a time capsule.
It was a time capsule.
That is fantastic. Up in the rear end.
In the rear end of
Jesus.
Yes.
Oh, my.
I thought that was, they actually kept the original note out and gave it to one of the archbishops and then put a photocopy of the original back in the original place.
I can't help but wonder, how on earth did they find out about a secret cavern in the bowels of a Jesus statue? Like, how does that come about?
I think they were just like fixing it up again kind of thing, and they came across some creases in the back end.
Working? Oh, my. I'm just going to stop.
You better stop. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, we're kind of walking the fine line
we're
between
But sacrilege. That is fascinating.
Isn't that?
I don't know what it is, but when you're studying history, and this is a good segue of where we're going here. It's fascinating to know how people thought and acted, and just even modern day, you know, just what did everyday life look like for them?
I mean, this guy's name was Joaquin Minguez.
I'm sure you pronounced that perfectly as well.
I thought I did. But anyway, it's on the internet. You can check it out.
Yeah.
It's very cool.
Classic. Well, hey, we are getting into a series that we're going to be working on here called The Human Project. Mm-hmm. This is something that we've been working on for over many years, in fact. Mm-hmm. And let's just clear up a little bit of confusion for some people out there. We began this series by calling it Zombie Culture.
Right.
We called it Zombie Culture for years until we got in conversations with publishing this with Zondervan. And they pushed back and said, we don't think that's a good title, nor do we think it's a good approach. You should rethink it. And we took that advice and we began to rethink it and came up with The Human Project. So we really were at one side of that coin with the zombie culture. We were approaching this topic from the dehumanization aspect. And the switching of the gears was to really focus on the humanization mm-hmm. with The Human Project. And the other thing was, instead of using philosophical thought experiments from zombies, using actual historical events as a entryway into these conversations on specifically four questions. And those four questions that constitute the Human Project are, what is human? What's the value of human life? What leads to human flourishing? And how should humans live? And so what we want to do for the next 4 weeks is we're going to look at each one of those. Today we're going to be looking at the question, what is human? And to do that, first one of the, you know, take a moment before we talk about the humanization aspect of it. I want to look at the dehumanization aspect of it. And specifically, I want to look at a historical event and see what can we learn from this event. And I'm sure you guys have all heard of the genocide in Rwanda. Perhaps you've seen the movie Hotel Rwanda.
I remember watching that for the first time and just being shocked at. I mean, it's one thing to hear the word genocide; it doesn't mean anything to us. But when you actually see it played out, and the kinds of things, like kinds of emotions that are involved in it, and the kind of anger and bitterness, and just the sheer blood that's everywhere. It just hits you in a different way. I'm like, the word genocide really comes alive then, and you see how horrific this is.
And by genocide, we're talking about the systematic extermination of another group of people for a specific reason. That could be their ethnicity. That could be their tribe. In this case, the tribe that they come from. We've seen historically that people will base this on different things, but really targeting a specific group of people and systematically seeking to eradicate them. And this is exactly what we found took place in Rwanda. Now, it's a long, complicated story of how this all happened. And in fact, next week, we're going to talk a little bit more about the foundations of what led to this genocide. But today, we just want to briefly talk about what took place. Specifically, on April 6, 1994, the entire country of Rwanda came under the grip of genocide, and this had been brewing for a while, long years. Mm-hmm. And the event that kicked it off was the plane crash of the president of Rwanda. His death, it led to conspiracy theories and whatnot, and the Hutu, you know, said, no, the Tutsis did it. And this really just kind of sparked, this was the last straw for them in their minds, right? That said, no, it's time to eradicate the Tutsis.
Why was it the last straw? That implies that something had been, like the Hutus have been, they've had reasons to hold some grudges against the Tutsis. Where did that come from?
Yeah, what I was saying is I want to kind of get more into that next week, is what led up to that. I mean, just to give you maybe a little teaser, I guess, is that the Tutsis had been put in charge of the Hutu.
Okay.
And the Tutsis had mistreated the Hutu for years.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Now there were more Hutu than Tutsis, and the Hutu were coming into power through just force and into politically, and had purchased, I believe it was around a 500,000 machetes in preparation for what they called the final solution. This is a term that you're familiar with.
Yeah, the Nazis used that.
That's right. Yeah. That they borrowed from the Nazis, and so for them this was their final solution. I was reading the book Left to Tell, which follows the story of Immaculée Ilibagaza, that talks about what she experienced, and I had the opportunity to talk to survivors of the Rwanda genocide. Some talked to you in person, some on the phone, and heard from them what happened, and it was truly horrendous for Immaculée. She ran to the house of a nearby Hutu pastor who, thankfully, this wasn't always the case, sadly, but thankfully he took her and a number of other women, six other Tutsi women, and hid them in his bathroom. Yeah. And they were hiding there for 91 days in a 3-foot by 4-foot bathroom. I mean, it's amazing that anybody could survive that. The genocide lasted for 100 days. Yikes. And during that 100 days, over 800,000 people were murdered, most of them murdered by machete. You can imagine, she tells about how people would come into the house and she could hear them. She could even recognize their voice. That's my neighbor, you know, looking for Tutsis to kill. And she talked about, you know, how she would be praying and asking, you know, God, please save me. Amazingly, she survived, and so did others, and were, you know, left to tell their story about the horrendous acts that took place. And as we have seen these genocides that have taken place around the world, from Turkey, Germany, Cambodia, Iraq, Bosnia, Kosovo, and then when we start to expand our consideration to other heinous acts against people, such as slavery, rape, torture, what you begin to see is a picture of humanity that is bleak. I mean, there really is no place in the planet that has not been affected by this sort of hatred, this level of callousness and murder. When you look at these events, one of the questions that you just can't help but ask is how? How is that possible? How do you have an entire country turn on themselves? I mean, a lot of people participated in killing Tutsis. It wasn't like it was a few. It takes a lot of people to kill 800,000 in 100 days. One person was murdered every 2 seconds. That's a lot of killing. So one of those questions that, you know, that we continually come back to, as I was saying, is how did this happen? You know, how are these sorts of things possible? And one of the things that catches a lot of people off guard, and I have to confess that this was true for me, is a lot of us have this idea from the history that we've read that the people who did these kind of things in places like Rwanda or Germany were horrible people. These were monstrous people. Mm-hmm. But Steve, we've read a lot of this material over the years together, and the thing that we continually come back to is
just how normal they are. They're average people like you and me, right? I mean, yeah. We on this side of the 20th century, especially when a lot of these things happened, we on this side of history, we look back and go, oh, wow, what monsters they were. You know, if I were in their shoes, I would never do those things. But in fact, that is not true. One of the books that we read for our theodicy course at Biola when I was doing my master's was, and I mentioned this book a number of times, Ordinary Men by Christopher Browning, I think is his name. And it was about the police battalion reserve, I think 104 or something like that. And they were in charge of rounding up the Jews and executing them. And these are your neighbors. These are your average blue-collar workers. These are not some special monsters that are just really callous. Or what about Ted Bundy? One of the things that would really strike you when you watch an interview of him is just how normal he seems.
Yeah. And this is why, by the way, I think movies like Quentin Tarantino's Inglourious Bastards is actually really unhelpful and actually not good for people, because the history, not only, is it an R-rated movie? I mean, put that aside, but its history is just so wrong. It is a story of Nazis that paints them to be these malicious, demonic people, but in actuality, it couldn't be farther from the truth. I mean, when Eichmann, for example, was put on trial, and he was one of the guys responsible for Auschwitz. And if you want to know more about him, Netflix has a number of documentaries, and even there's a miniseries right now that's on there about this whole thing, Eichmann in Jerusalem. And what they found when they put this guy on trial, they were all anticipating an absolute monster to be on trial. And what they found to be, even more insidious is that he was a normal guy, that he was a loving father. He was a great husband. Like, he's a normal guy that had a dangerously distorted worldview when it came to Jews. And it was interesting because a Jew by the name of Dunor was put on trial, and he was one of the few that survived Auschwitz. And after his testimony, he faints. You know, later he's interviewed about what happened, and he said, you know, I believe years later, and he's had time to process it, he said, you know, the reason I fainted is when I saw Eichmann, I realized he's just an ordinary man, just like me. And he goes, and I began to realize that I was capable of the very same thing that he did. Now, there were Christians, by the way, and I think we should point this out, that did not do and did not follow suit with the Nazis. You know, many, such as
the Confessing Churches, Dietrich Bonhoeffer was one.
Yeah.
In fact, he was part of an assassination attempt on Hitler, yeah.
But sadly, there were a number of Christians that did participate, you know, and that's something that you have to reckon with. You know, again, it brings us back to this question, how is that possible? And one of the key ideas that my time studying these things has shown me, and this is one of the things that we talk about in the first session of The Human Project, is that people do not murder people. And I put it that way just kind of to grab people's attention. My time studying this stuff, I have yet to see a historical example of where a person murders another person. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not talking about killing. I mean, you may accidentally kill somebody, or you may kill somebody to protect yourself or somebody else. I'm talking about the desire to willfully take another human being's life. What you find is that to do that, you will either need to first dehumanize yourself or dehumanize the other being and the other person. And most often what we see historically is the dehumanization of the other person. Mm-hmm. Now, I've read plenty of stuff from prison testimonies and interviews in which the inmate has dehumanized themselves. And this is what made their acts possible. But that tends to be fairly rare. It tends to be more the dehumanization of the other person.
Yeah. If you want a good example of that kind of an inmate who has dehumanized himself and others, read about Karl Panzram. Now, there's a guy who really lived out his ethics of might makes right and just dehumanized absolutely everybody, including himself. Panzram, Panzram. I think there's, again, a documentary on his life on Netflix.
And so this is an important concept then to understand, is that when a person begins to view another person as less than human, then they are capable of literally they're capable of anything. One of the things that you'll notice historically is that not only do people not murder people, but people don't enslave people either. I've yet to see an example of where a person is being enslaved. They are always first dehumanized as something less than human. You see this with Aristotle all the way up into the modern times. They're always made into something less than human. And once they're no longer seen as a human being, if they're just a monkey or whatever it might be, well, then it's quite easy to enslave them and to torture them and to do whatever you want with them. I mean, they're just an animal at that point. And when we look at like the slave trade that happened in the West, consistently, they did not see these people as human. They saw them as less than human, and it was in that way that they were able to justify their actions.
Would you say the same thing about Hitler exterminating the Jews? Like, he didn't see the Jews as people, but something less than human?
Well, of course, right? I mean, what did they refer to the Jews as? They were consistently referred to as rats. Now, let me just put it this way, because I think this might help people to begin to wrap their minds around this. If you could go back in time and you could have a conversation with Hitler and you could say, you know, Hitler, you know, I see what you're doing here with the Jews. You know, don't you think it's wrong to murder people? I believe that Hitler most likely would have said to you, of course it's wrong to murder people. But then through his twisted, distorted perspective, he would have explained to you that the Jews are in fact not people, that they're a parasite. That's often how they refer to. And in his mind, he saw himself as doing the world a favor by eradicating this pest. And by the way, we see this consistently, particularly with genocide. Genocide is always preceded by a campaign of dehumanization. There are two main ways that people dehumanize other people, either by equating them as an object or an animal. Mm-hmm. Most often in the past, we saw people being equated with an animal. These days, it's more and more an object, and we'll explain that more as we go through these. But with regards to an animal, the Jews were referred to as rats. They were referred to as parasites. In the time of the Rwanda genocide, the Tutsis were referred to as cockroaches.
Mm-hmm. Or sometimes the Hutus talked about cutting down the tall trees, right? Because the Tutsis generally were taller than the Hutus.
And they also called them snakes as well. And so again, in their mind, they didn't see themselves as killing people. If you start to think about that, you begin to understand that they were able to kill these people because in their minds, that's not what they were doing. They had dehumanized them into something less than human, which made it very easy for them to kill 800,000 Tutsis in 100 days. Because mm-hmm. that's not the way that they saw it from their distorted perspective. Now, if we begin to understand the significance of that, and by the way, when you study psychology on this, in the different journal articles and the research that's been done over the last number of years, in particular, really inspired by what happened in World War II to try to grapple with what humanity is capable of. Again, you find that all of these reports continually push back to the same idea. How is this possible? Dehumanization is how it's possible. And this is across the board people coming to this consensus. And not only is dehumanization possible, every person is capable of dehumanizing another person. And what you begin to realize is that your perspective needs to be corrected. It needs to be adjusted because for all of us, our perspective of another human being can come out of focus in the same way that your eyesight can lose focus. So your worldview.
Yeah, and I think it really needs to be emphasized here because this can just kind of really, we can gloss over it really quickly. Everybody is capable of dehumanization. That means me, that means you around the table, and it means you, the listener who's listening to this right now, you, not the person next to you, you are capable of doing this very thing that we're talking about.
And I would argue that we do it all the time.
A lot of people would question that. I'm a good person, right?
Yeah.
They'd almost be defensive of that. So how can that be true?
And I'm glad that you bring that up because it happens first in subtle ways. And particularly it happens through the language that you use. And that's why I was making the argument, we do dehumanizing things on a regular basis, such as when you're in traffic and somebody cuts you off. What are the sorts of things that you call that other person? Mm-hmm. They're never positive things, right? They're often negative and they're often dehumanizing. We will often equate another human being as an object or an animal. Often the word that comes to a lot of people's mouth is some different type of feces or something else, mm-hmm. right? That's horrendous, and that's what they'll blurt out about that other individual.
And another really good and very common example of this is your view of that particular politician that you don't like, right? It's super easy to dehumanize that person. I know, for example, Donald Trump gets a lot of hate. To many people, Donald Trump is nothing less than
Fill in the blank.
Yeah.
If you got kids, we're trying to be
and you could say the same thing about Hillary Clinton, Justin Trudeau, whatever politician that you don't like.
So we have a lot of labels that we put on
labels.
People,
you reduce that person to whatever that person represents.
Well, think about how our culture will do this with police officers. They're often mm-hmm. referred to as pigs. I mean, there's all sorts of names that police officers are given. But then I've talked to lots of police officers, and we see this in movies and elsewhere, the kind of terminology that will be said of the criminal, right? Referred to as a dog, referred to as a rat, and the list goes on. Now, the question I think you're getting at here, though, Terry, is there's a difference between calling people those things and treating people as those things.
Mm. Yeah.
And what you find historically is it always starts with calling people those things. Mm-hmm. And slowly what the words that you use about another human being will begin to affect the way that you see them. And it's a slow progression till the day comes that you begin to act in those sorts of ways. And you will do so on a large scale, from a small scale to a large scale. So now we're dealing with an extreme here, and that is genocide. But there's other kinds of genocides, though, that even take place around us right now, and we can see the terminology and how they affect us. For example, in abortion, babies are not referred to as babies. Mm-hmm. They are referred to as a fetus. See, that's dehumanizing terminology because it's very easy to discard a clump of cells or a fetus. And in fact, one of the most dehumanizing terms for a baby is to not even refer to the baby at all. Ending a pregnancy.
Right. And the term that really drives me bonkers is because I have a family member who's, you know, studying in the medical field. And she tells me that they're often referred to as, products of conception. Especially in the early stages, and that is bonkers.
That is incredibly dehumanizing, and it'll because when that kind of terminology is used, it becomes very easy to discard, to kill, to murder a baby. But that's why it's so important that we understand our terminology and how it affects us. But what I want to do now is begin to change our focus here. So we looked at dehumanization, asked how is it possible, and we saw, well, it's possible by seeing somebody as less than human. You can begin to see then how important this first question of the Human Project is. What is human? If we are not going to behave in those sorts of ways, if we are, you know, if we're going to humanize, we have to know what a human being actually is.
In talking about what a human is, there is this very common mistake that we make, right? So, for example, in the library, Andy, you mentioned a while ago that you found this book, children's book called "We're All Stardust."
That's right. I'm in the library with my kid, and we find this book called "You Are Stardust."
You are Stardust.
You open it up and you see that it was sponsored by the Canadian government of all things. And as I begin to read this book, it explains to your child that, you know, with great pictures, that they are made of carbon. Carbon is made from dying stars. Thus, as Carl Sagan famously put it, he first started calling it "you're made of star stuff," which then got changed to "you're made of stardust." The question that comes to mind, though, is, and you should be asking, is that it? Am I just, a clump of stardust? Am I just dirt? Because one of the things that was going through my mind as I'm sitting there with my son is, one of the most important tasks that we have as parents is to help our children understand who they are and to help them to understand who other people are as we seek to train them in how to live in this world. And one of the things that you'll see is that in our culture today, and this is why this is such an important question, and that is because we live in a culture today that is called a reductive culture. So that today, if you want to know what something is, you reduce that thing to what it's made of. And then that becomes its ontological status, we would say. That's its existence, is its parts. And the problem with that, that I hope is immediate to people, is that that's incredibly dehumanizing. I mean, would you ever want your child to believe that they were just stardust and to treat other people as just dirt?
Yeah, I mean, you can push that a little bit farther too. And I've mentioned my distaste for this whole stardust business because guess what else is made of stardust? A pile of feces is made of stardust. Right? Are you really saying that you are equal to a pile of feces? And if not, what's the difference?
And this is the inconsistency of our world. I mean, you know, people would say, "Well, no, of course not." But if that's the case, then what are we going to say that you are? If you're not just your parts, well, then what are you?
I mean, this idea is so entrenched in our culture. And as it has grown and kind of enveloped our culture, I mean, Nietzsche way back said God is dead. Could you address that?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up, because that starts to point to what are the implications to this kind of thinking, this sort of materialistic reductionist thinking that began to form out of the Enlightenment as the universe began to be seen and referred to more and more as a clockwork universe, that it's just a collection of parts behaving, you know, as a machine. And again, when I start using that kind of word, that terminology, machine, right? And if the universe is a machine and you're part of the universe, well, what are you? Mm-hmm. Well, you're a machine. You're part of the gears and the springs that make up the whole system. That's dehumanizing. Now we just are referring to a person as an object. Yeah. Right?
And just a bag of chemicals and bones.
Right. And people, you know, we'll often hear people talk like that, you know, that you're just a bag of parts. You're a bag of chemicals. And what Nietzsche understood was that when you remove God from the equation, that what you have is just the parts, and you have the random arrangement of those parts. Sure, call it a machine, but it's an accidental machine. There is no purpose to that machine. And in that way, Nietzsche was saying, well, God's dead. And basically, he wasn't saying that we had like actually killed God. God never even existed. He's just saying we're just coming to grips with the realization that in a world that's purely mechanical, that's purely physical, there's not even any room for God in that worldview. Not only is there no room for God, who is non-physical, but there's no room for anything else that's non-physical in the gears and the springs of this mechanical universe. There's no room for things like purpose. There's no room for things like value or meaning. They actually all become meaningless under this worldview, which, by the way, I hope the absurdity that jumps out to people when you call something meaningless, because you seem to think that that's meaningful. That's kind of the irony of it all, is it really starts to fall apart on itself. This is incredibly what we'd call a reductio ad absurdum. I mean, this leads to absurd conclusions that you, in fact – now, this is where things get interesting with a philosopher by the name of Michael Polanyi, who some of you know I'm currently doing my PhD work on him. And that is that he
– although that'd be pretty cool if you did it under him.
That would be great, although he's dead. And that is that he understood that this clockwork universe not only led to the death of God, it led to the death of humanity. You in fact never even existed. You're just a part of the machinery. Mm-hmm. You might think you exist, but you in fact don't. This should all be pointing people to how dangerous these worldviews are, how dehumanizing these worldviews are, and thankful that people don't act on these worldviews that are taught and embraced in the university.
It's just taken for granted, right? This kind of physicalist worldview, the idea that the physical stuff is all we have in this world.
Yeah.
And if that is your worldview, then in principle, this world can't hold anything immaterial like personhood, like ethics, like value or duties or everything.
The list goes on.
Yeah, everything that we actually, that in a sense makes us human, yep. Right? Sets us apart from the physical stuff of which we're made.
Now, this is where things get interesting, is because nobody lives as though this is true. Right, people give lip service to materialism, and it's just a purely physical universe. But nobody lives as though that's true. I mean, the reality is that you can't. And daily, when we refer to things in the world, we always refer to things not by their parts. I mean, that would be a very weird world if every time I asked somebody what something was, they told me what it was made of. We would immediately go, no. I know it's made of plastic. I'm asking you, what is it? And it's interesting that we always define a thing not by its parts, but by the purpose of the whole. So it's interesting from the very get-go, our understanding of the universe is very teleologically driven, we would say. It's very design or purposely driven, because we understand that from our own first-person perspective of a creator. I can make things. I can...
For example, if I were to, let's say somebody asked me, well, what is this? I could say, well, this is a wooden shaft with a curved metal plate, and half circular part attached on the other end. Or I could just tell you it's a shovel, right? Because that's what it is. That's what it's made for. It's made for – a shovel is made for digging the dirt. That's what a shovel is. It's not just the parts that they're made of. So then you could extend that to humanity.
That's right. Now we ask the question, well, what is a human being? And this is where theology comes into the conversation, because now we're talking about who is the creator of the universe? Who is the creator of life? I clearly did not create myself. I didn't bring myself into existence, I can put it that way. And so this isn't a question I can answer. This is a question for the architect, the engineer of the universe. Mm-hmm. Now, I think, by the way, that's an important distinction to make, is that there is a difference. We see this in science. There is a difference between pure science, somebody who studies, say, physics, and applied science, somebody who studies, say, engineering. We get that there is a difference. We understand that the universe does follow physical laws. Physics. But we also understand that an engineer can come along and take those parts and arrange them into a purposeful whole, like a bridge, and they follow the laws that are imposed on them by the engineer. Mm-hmm. Now, those laws can disobey the engineer, they can break down, but the physical laws are not going to. What we see in the Bible from Genesis chapter 1 is that God created the heavens and the earth. He created the physical parts, and he created the laws that those physical parts follow. But then God comes along as a person, as a creator, as an engineer. And we see in Genesis 2 verse 7 that God takes the dust of the earth. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't have a problem with people being made of dust, but that's not what we are. The Bible explains that God takes that dust, takes those parts, and arranges them into a purposeful whole, a human being, and breathes life into that human being. And as we're going to look at next week, endows that human being with his very image, that we are made in the image and likeness of God. And that's significant. It plays to the purpose which God creates us for. So we can understand then from that perspective that the universe is not just a physical universe following physical laws of mechanics. We even understand that for us. We understand that there's a difference between the parts and the purposeful whole that something's made for. There's a difference between pure science and there's a difference between applied science. And what we're saying here is that you are created by God, that you were created for a purpose. And Jesus expresses this purpose throughout the New Testament, and it's a purpose that was from the Old Testament, and that is that you were made for the purpose, or how Jesus puts it, the most important law or the most significant thing to understand is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and to love your neighbors yourself. You were created for the purpose of relationship. The Bible explains that God created you because he loves you and desires for you to be in relationship with him and relationship with other people. You are a relational being. You are made of parts, but that's the purpose you were created for, is relationship. And this is interesting because Jesus is quoting from the Shema from Deuteronomy chapter 6. And this is a very Hebraic understanding of what a human being is. A human being is looked at as that holistic understanding. You know, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, strength. You know, it's talking about everything that it is to be a human being. Love God with all of that, knowing that you are loved. And then it's from there that God wants to help you to understand how to love other people.
This whole project is talking about our perspectives and how we have to change that towards others. Mm-hmm. I love how you put it, that we are the human project. Mm-hmm. Do you want to elaborate on that?
And ultimately, I think, Terry, what you're getting at is that's where everything's leading to. This is why we called it the human project. Because that's exactly what we are. We are the human project, as we are seeking to correct in our perspective where we are not seeing ourselves and each other correctly. And the only way to do that, the only way to make that adjustment, and this is the key piece of the human project, is that if you want to see yourself correctly, if you want to see other people correctly, you first need to see God correctly. That's the genesis of the human project. One of the things we're going to get into next week is that we are made in the image of God. That being the case, your view of God is the most important view that you have. It's going to inform who and what you are. And so what we want to do is in doing this series, we want to get a correct perspective of God so that we can begin to get a correct perspective of ourselves that will help us to continually adjust and readjust where we have distorted our perspective of ourselves or other people in particular so that we see the world correctly. We see ourselves and we see other people correctly.
All right. Well, let's wrap up there. As we wrap up, you probably noticed that Andy assumed a whole lot of things, you know, towards the end, you know, that God exists and you know, what the Bible tells us is reliable and these things. Now, if you have been following what Apologetics Canada has been doing over the last few years, you understand that we've put out another video resource series called the Thinking Series, where we actually address a lot of these questions.
In fact, that's the foundation that these things are working from.
Right. If you find that we're making a lot of assumptions, you might want to actually go to the Thinking Series and check out that resource. You can do that by going to thinkingseries.com.
And as well, if you haven't gone to the Human Project yet, you can go to thehumanproject.ca and check that out. March, this resource is launching, and you can host this series at your church. You can host this in coffee shop. You can host this with friends. Mm-hmm. Great resource. Let me just say this as we close. The resource is made up of two things, and so is the Thinking Series. It has a short video that tells you a short story that raises the question, gets you discussing it, and then the second portion is teaching. It's myself doing the teaching. We've worked long and hard putting this all together, and we think it will lead to some great discussions. So short video leads to discussion, teaching then leads to discussion. It takes about an hour.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us, listeners. The Apologetics Canada podcast has been a Ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll see you next week with part two of The Human Project. See you next week.
If you enjoy and appreciate the AC podcast, show us some love on iTunes. Please consider leaving a review. It helps us keep doing what we're doing.